Welcome back to Radio Rothbard. I'm Ryan McMakin. I'm a senior editor with the Mises Institute, and we're back again for our second show of 2022. And this time we're going to talk about predictions for the rest of the year. And joining me to do that is Tho Bishop, my associate editor, and we're going to just talk about two or three things that we think are likely to happen this year, or maybe they're not likely, but it could be a wishful thinking prediction. It could be just a prediction we're bringing up because we just wanted to talk about something. But we're going to call them predictions, and these are going to be things that are going to happen in 2022, at least in some versions of reality. And so, Tho, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Excited for this episode. I think the political landscape right now is very, very interesting in all sorts of ways, and I think this is going to be a good way of setting some. You know, what I'm looking to try to do is identify some benchmarks that will show that things are progressing in a way that we should be optimistic about, or things that would identify that things are going poorly. And so that's I'm fairly optimistic about where some of the trends are going. These are some of the measures that I'm looking forward to see if I'm on the right track or completely in delusional land, which both are perfectly possible. At this point.
Well, let's go ahead and dive into it then. Why don't you go ahead and start us off with your first prediction?
So my first prediction is that Greg Abbott is not going to win the Republican primary as governor of Texas this year, which would be a huge, huge change. You know, we focus a lot on kind of national stuff, but I think state-level Republican Party politics is very interesting in its own right. We've seen the importance of strong governors generally, both on the left and the right, the last five or so years. And I think Texas offers a very interesting situation where you have what has long been a very establishment-controlled state party. 30 plus years, only one governor of Texas was not previously a statewide official, either lieutenant governor, attorney general, the like. That one person was George W. Bush, who had some own advantages in his own right in that regard, right? And I think if you have a situation where you have a non-Abbott Republican win that party, it will show a massive change of what a state the size of Texas, that political infrastructure that has lasted for decades, pushing a very particular party line within that state, very much that old Bush era sort of stuff. If that gets thrown out within a primary, I think it will be a demonstration that there is a strong you know, anti-establishment is a word that gets thrown out a lot and kind of loses its meaning over time. But I think this will show really a change in the party structure within Texas that will reflect a larger national trend. There's some other primaries that I'm interested in that. You've got some interesting congressional races where people are challenging incumbents and the like. But I think Abbott's race in particular is one that's going to be highlighted. And, you know, there's a lot of interesting candidates within that race. There is Colonel West, who's, you know, was a big Tea Party congressman from Florida back in the 2010 era. You have Don Huffines, who's a former state senator who has been endorsed by Ron Paul. He comes from a very strong ideological sort of group within the Texas right. Very, very strong person in ideologically that regard. You have a guy named Rick Perry that has jumped in who might be financed by someone else's campaign because simply the name Rick Perry on the Texas ballot, it immediately vaulted him to like 14% of the vote.
So this is a different Rick Perry. It's not Rick the old Perry, Rick Perry.
But they found someone with the right name. So he's on the ballot, and immediately he was in third place, I think, for the race. I'm not making a decision on who that alternative will be. But the interesting thing within a Florida election setup is that all of these candidates running against Abbott do not take away from each other in a tactical sense because it's a runoff state. So that the first race is coming up, I believe, in late February. If you get 50+1% of the vote, you win. If not, you go to a runoff of the top two. Keeping Abbott beneath that 50% mark will be huge. And then after that, you will have this consolidation push. But if that happens, that'd be very, very good for the state of Florida or for the state of Texas. It will be a very positive trend, I believe, for the Republican Party generally. And I think it will be a sign that, you know, perhaps there really is this political party realignment that we've talked about on this show and many others are as well.
Well, and if this is in a something else you plan to bring up later, just say so. But while we're on this topic, if you weren't going to mention this later, what's up with Wyoming and Cheney.
I mean, Liz Cheney has been formally censored like multiple times now by the Republican Party of Wyoming. She is deeply behind in a challenger with a challenging campaign against her. Who wins that role of being the anti-Liz Cheney candidate is still up in the air. The favorite in terms of money and things like that is, you know, someone who was on good terms with Liz Cheney before not too long. So I think that might be a little bit of a missed opportunity if you have someone who's simply not Liz Cheney but kind of still part of that old school party there. Hopefully there'll be a stronger challenge there. But again, at the very least, anytime you can throw a Cheney out from office is a good thing. And I think she is very much trending on that words. I could see her trying to resurrect herself within the Democratic Party, after everything's said and done here.
Yeah, that's one of the great things about Trump is whatever things he's done that I don't like, he's done a pretty good job of humiliating the Bushes and the Cheneys. And on that, I'm supportive.
Definitely one of the positive trends, I think, generally. And again, that's the whole thing. You know, there was a lot of issues with the Trump presidency, but in terms of the way that parties can realign, even on very petty stuff, right? Like voting wise, Liz Cheney voted with the Trump administration a lot more than a Rand Paul. The difference is it's those inner party disputes. It's some of the non-deeply ideological issues, particularly January 6th stuff that is really shaping that. And again, that's a positive thing. So that's the whole thing. It's like, you know, there's so much that goes into, you know, the power infrastructure of national politics that is not reflected necessarily within votes at the, you know, on the record. And I think that's one of the really interesting parts of this time period right now.
Well, my first prediction fits along these lines. My prediction is that the two parties will continue to realign. And I think we're starting to see some of that already with, say, the Hispanic vote, mm-hmm. where the Dems just really going overboard on hating on Christians, on embracing the whole, like, transgender thing, that this is really going to continue to alienate a lot of Hispanics. And ironically, also, a lot of the people who are really only first or second generation American as well, as they're going to come in and they're just going to they're going to be constantly told by these rich white people that their religion's stupid and that men are women and all that sort of thing. And I just don't think that's going to endear them, especially since the Republican Party doesn't seem to care anymore about welfare. So, I mean, the welfare issue is like, oh, you trim around the edges a little bit. But for the most part, nobody thinks their Social Security is going to get cut by Republicans and things like that anymore. So if economic populism is something that people are worried about, you just don't – that's not a reason to join one party or the other, because there's just tons of spending all around. So that issue seems to be not even particularly relevant. It's more of these cultural issues. And so there's that. There's the fact that the Democratic Party is becoming less and less, I think, the working class party, and that includes white people, i.e. Anglo-Saxons, as we call them, among Hispanics. But this is also going to include Hispanics. And as I've pointed out a long time, right, you're always being told in when you write columns like I do and stuff, I'm always getting these emails from people, many of whom are just bona fide racists, but a lot of whom are always saying that that Hispanics are genetically incapable of not voting for communists and so on. And so, right, we can always just count on like 90% of anyone who's not a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant to vote Democrat. And that's looking less and less like that is the near future. And people have picked up on this for a while now. If you go back and you look at it, fair number of columns and such from the last 20 years talking about how the trajectory of Hispanics is just the same as the trajectory of like Eastern Europeans and Italians and those sorts of people that we call ethnic whites. and they come into the country, they become more middle class and so on, and they start to view themselves more as property owners and as people who would like to keep some of their money and so on, and people who don't like to be talked down to as inferiors, which is generally what you get out of people like Nancy Pelosi. And so I'm not shocked that you're starting to see the party lose its grip on Hispanics, but apparently some people really are surprised. Other issues, too, are that intermarriage between Anglos and Hispanics is just so high and so on that there's not this clear-cut difference between the two groups. So I think, as you've started to see in some panicked columns from left-wingers and in some leaked internal emails and stuff, the party's starting to figure out that this is a significant problem, because if they're only getting half of the Hispanic vote, well, that just simply doesn't fit into their long-established plan of counting on anyone who isn't an Anglo to vote with them. And so it's really the lining up for them that they can't count on having this sort of lopsided support anymore. So if that were to continue, they would end up seeing themselves as some sort of permanent minority party, if that's a thing. So we'll see how that goes. And I think another major issue on that is the Dems seem to be more and more wetting themselves to not wetting themselves, but connecting themselves to the surveillance state. And whereas the Republican Party was just absolutely horrible and awful on foreign policy 20 years ago, and downright revolutionary, really, in all of this talk about democratic change worldwide and all sorts of regime change. And then, of course, they ushered in the USA Patriot Act and gave us the TSA, and I mean, the list is long of horrible, horrible things that occurred during the Bush years with this widespread support of Republicans. But now, as we discussed on our last episode, so much of the focus now is on stopping internal terrorism, and so that anyone who's basically to the right of, like, Mitt Romney is some sort of right-wing white supremacist terrorist, and so we need to do something to stop those people. And you have that, you have the Dems then doubling down on supporting the surveillance state and the intelligence state to help suppress these alleged right-wing terrorists. And then on top of that, you have the fact that the military officer corps is embracing this whole, like, woke ideology, for lack of a better term. And so when you look at there and you look at a military general, you can just imagine this guy spouting all sorts of countless like buzzwords that you might hear in a university faculty meeting, right? These people are all very similar now, a military Pentagon general and some sociology professor at some state college. They have the same worldview now in terms of wokeness and embracing inclusivity and using all the corporate buzzwords and so on. And as polls have shown in that article today from Jose Nino, that people are finally starting to figure out that the military's worldview is very different from that of the average American. And it was so frustrating for so long to see that no matter what the military did, no matter how many wars they lost, no matter how incompetent they obviously were, and of course I'm talking mostly about the officer corps here because, of course, like the regular people, they just take orders. They're taking it now to a next level where they're an engine of social change and trying to push through the left-wing culture war. And I think that's going to just further realign the Pentagon with the Democratic Party and lose them support with the Republicans. So I think that if the Democrats continue down this road of losing support with Hispanics and with the pro-military people, that, boy, that's going to be a pretty deep wound for the Democratic Party. And that could be a real realignment too. And of course would be good if the Republican Party could at least hold the line somewhat on pretending to be the party that's a little less crazy about government spending, at least when there's not a Republican in the White House. I mean, obviously everything was completely off the rails when Trump was president in terms of printing money and deficit spending and all of that. They're like, you know, maybe 1% better than the Dems in that regard. And so if you just have that, but you're also turn the Republicans into the not as crazed military party, that could be a big improvement too. And so it could then be that my old feelings of betrayal about the Republican Party might be glossed over a little bit. It might be less dangerous. And I'm always reminded of a column that Lou Rockwell wrote back in 1999. It was called Dreading Republican Rule. And he was predicting what would happen if George W. Bush became president and also the Republicans had control of Congress. And he was absolutely correct, right? There was runaway spending. The Republicans doubled down on their version of the regulatory state. Of course, it was the Republicans who passed Medicare Part D back before the 2004 election. And so it was just everything was awful. Plus all the military adventurism. And so maybe this realignment could actually lead to one of the parties being not quite as awful as the other. If that continues, then that would certainly be good news. I don't think that's obviously going to come to its fruition in 2022, but maybe the trend is a real thing and maybe it'll continue for the rest of the year. I don't know.
No, we have to defend the American intelligence agencies. After all, they are the great champions of democracy in the world. Ryan.
Well, and that's another good thing about Trump, right? Is really just exposing how cynical the FBI is, how the FBI is there to protect the FBI. And it's like running behind the scenes schemes to get their man in office and spy on people they don't like. I mean, really despicable stuff. So, yes, another good outcome of the 2016 election.
No, but I think you're right about the general realignment right here. We've seen this play up a little bit. DeSantis and others did pretty okay with Hispanic voters in 2018. Major, major shift in 2020. We've already seen it play out in small little races in 2021. The importance of the culture, of cultural politics, is something that I think a lot of people get wrong. I think there's a lot of libertarians that have missed this for a very long time. Even there's a part of like the populist right that is convinced like that these major shifts with the working class is because of, you know, their own little pet projects. Oh, it's because we were talking about infrastructure spending, you know, here, or, you know, and it's like, no, it's because there's a lot of people that just don't want the government saying it's okay for your son to mutilate themselves. Like, you just hit something, you know, if you look throughout, you know, Latin American politics, it's perfectly fine. Like, there's definitely a appetite there for perhaps not a true minarchist state in many of these areas, but you can't be promoting democratic socialism and hate God. And that's exactly the tenor that you're seeing with the Democratic Party right now. I think that it's going to be interesting to see the degree to which Republicans pivot in terms of policies really directing, you know, trying to push favor to non-college educated young people in particular. I think that's going to end up shaping some if the Republican Party is smart at riding this wave out, I think that's going to be a big thing. I also think it's interesting because like Republicans have been trying to cultivate Hispanic voters for a very long time. You know, the idea like, oh, well, you know, these are Christian, this is a Christian voting bloc in theory, they should support us. But I think it's something to be said that this change happened in spite of or during, you know, a very hard rhetorical pivot within the Republican Party on the immigration issue. Because there's so much like just stereotyping amongst political pundits on both the left and right. That's like, oh, well, the way to appeal to Hispanic voters is, you know, really shameless, superficial sort of things and really pushing a very strong open borders perspective. And it's like, no, there is a lot of you know, there's a lot of Hispanics that came here legally. And there is this issue that they don't like the idea of freeloaders coming in. Like they're very much sort of is, like you mentioned, like that sort of you know, I've made it here and I want to protect what I have sort of mentality. And I think that, you know, the degree to which if you have a Republican Party that is successful at energizing, you know, what Sam Francis used to call it, the middle American, you know, radical types. That I think would be something that would be a very strong, an indication that the political party system that we have right now really is fundamentally shifting, which again, I think would be encouraged based on just how poor the political party system has been for a very long time.
All right. Well, number three on predictions, what have you?
Well, it kind of builds off of that a little bit. I think that there is a lot of turmoil within the Democratic Party in terms of promoting a positive message. You know, Build Back Better has been killed by, you know, Manchin and Sinema in the Senate. Biden was in Georgia yesterday pounding the table for getting rid of the filibuster to pass a new voting rights law, which is that's one of those issues. I know you've written several articles about the dangers of nationalizing elections. Like, I'll tell you that you talk to Republicans, like if they actually you break the filibuster to impose anything that the Republicans see as interfering with election integrity, like that is going to be one of those line in the sand sort of things. I'll tell you that right now. I don't think it's going to work out that way. But the desperation of putting out anything positive from a platform perspective, I think, is going to lead to my prediction, which is we are going to see the Biden administration double down on criminal charges against Trump World, whether that comes in the form of the state of New York seriously prosecuting tax issues against Donald Trump himself, whether that comes from attempts to broaden the scope of the federal January 6th investigations and arresting, Mark Meadows, former congressman, Donald Trump's chief of staff, perhaps something involving, one of the kids. I think we're going to see, particularly as we get closer to the midterms, the Biden administration is going to push the idea that the Trump family are crazy criminals that hate democracy and, cats and dogs. And they're going to go on a strong negative campaign, and they're going to use the levers of power that they do have for gaudy show trials and perhaps genuine criminal prosecution of some of the major players in that orbit, just to further lean on that message that, the Republican Party is evil, right? And they're going to do that because they can't get a policy message through.
Yeah, well, we've already seen that right in the January 6th thing, as that's just been a major goal, is that rhetoric, the idea of revolution, and that people are, it's insurrection, it's a new civil war, it's the worst thing that's happened since 9/11 or Pearl Harbor, or even the Civil War is what's been said in a couple of cases. And so that's really quite remarkable. I think it only ends up then alienating half the country. So that only moves the U.S. further towards some sort of division.
Yeah. Friends might be too strong of a word, but I know people that are, the sort of person that goes and knocks on doors for Democratic campaigns that do not live in D.C. And they're, they're freaking out about the idea. Like, this is what the party is fixated on right now, is trying to push the January 6th narrative. Like, that does nothing to help the material well-being of the people that just showed up in historic numbers to vote Biden into office, in 2020. And while, we can dismiss, the electorate as a large as being a bunch of dupes and whatever, like they do have, perhaps Americans don't have the longest memory in the world, but they do, like, the issue of the inflation issue in particular is that it's a daily reminder that they are worse off than they were before the last election. And again, regardless of, printing under Trump, is a big role here, right? It's just timing ends up working this way. There's an inability of the Democrats to deliver anything that can materially help the sort of people they need to turn out. And that's also true at the state level. The biggest push within Florida right now is Democrats trying to pivot on making housing a big issue, just the lack of affordable housing, which I think is a very strong issue to run on. The problem is that it's difficult to replicate generally it's easy to just blame all inflation, every inflation to the federal policies in general. But like if other states outside of Florida, like where Democrats have power, you can't run on that issue because your guys are the ones in charge. And so like they've got themselves, I think, in a trap where they're so bad at governing, beyond just like kind of the ideological differences, like they aren't good at providing material, rewards to the people that vote for them anymore. And their big push is representation, and it's fixated on pronouns, the bio, all this woke stuff that does not help your average Democratic voter in a big, big way. And again, it's just that dynamic of that cultural bubble of, particularly in political circles in general. Like, for example, any Democratic staffer that put Joe Biden at a Georgia rally the day after the Georgia Bulldogs break a 41-year streak, like it just that disconnect where the people making strategic decisions for the Democratic Party, I think, are culturally so isolated from normal people in a way that, you know, the political class has always been full of people that don't have a lot of self-awareness. I think that that divide is even bigger now than it ever has been in a very long time.
Yeah, I can just think of all the people I've known who were big-time Democratic strategists, and they were always like upper middle class white kids from out in the suburbs, like about 100% of the time, and heavily ideological. They had big plans for completely reforming society, and they just seem to have precious little grasp of how much of the country lives. And also, a lot of these people who were working on the campaigns, and they were these young, ambitious people, they didn't even have families or anything. They didn't even know on a personal level what ordinary life is like. And so if that's what the Democratic Party is up to, that's not going to endear them to the people they claim to be representing.
If you just think back in terms of modern history of the Democratic Party, think of how much Democrats were kind of checked in the 90s by Bill Clinton and James Carville. Right. He's like, you know, Bill Clinton, for all of his other sins, I mean, like the guy understood your average Southerner, right? Like he understood, you know, he had that, you know, a great level of empathy for, you know, the guy living in the trailer park. And Carville made his mark, you know, creating a Democratic message for those people. You know, that you don't have, I don't think, anything similar out there when you have a political class that is looking up to like people like Pete Buttigieg, and you know, it is, and you know, Kamala Harris, right? Like it is a complete disconnect that I think is just, you know, if we're looking for things that are contributing to a genuine breakdown of the political party system that has governed this country for decades, I think these are the little cultural dynamics that end up really kind of shaking things up in a way that is more than what you see in a single election, right? It's more than that.
Well, Bill Clinton was a masterful politician. I don't think anyone can deny that, whether you agreed with the guy or not. And he was the last president from either party who had a somewhat normal upbringing. In fact, if anything, his upbringing was extremely disadvantaged, I think, compared to a lot of people. And I mean, who do you got in contrast to that? Obama, whose mom was a university professor, and he grew up in some sort of weird kind of, I'm not sure what the connections were to like the Treasury Secretary at the time. And I mean, this was not a normal upbringing, growing up in other countries and so on, in little pods of highly educated white people and such. And then obviously, right, Trump and George W. Bush have no clue what it means to worry at night about where your rent check's going to come from next month. So, yeah, a very different situation. And I think in many cases that's backed both parties into a corner. But this populist turn, at least in the GOP, I think is forcing a lot of people. And you're starting to see that even like Kevin McCarthy, right, is grudgingly trying to find some way to endear himself to some of these populist people and saying things like, yeah, I'm not going to play by Washington rules and I'm going to be tough. And yeah, we'll see it. We'll see if that happens. But that's obvious pandering.
Yeah, I wish I could say that I'm predicting that Kevin McCarthy will be thrown out of the Republican Party leadership, but I will not be making that position, that prediction.
Well, of course, that's my big fear. God, this relates to all the things we've been discussing, is that this is going to be a repeat yet again of 1996, right? It was 94 and 96 when the Republicans took over the House and Senate.
Yeah, I believe it was 94.
You're right, yeah, because it wasn't a presidential year.
Right.
It was 94, and there was this big Republican sweep, and then one of the last columns that Murray Rothbard ever wrote was a column to predict that the Republicans would betray the whole thing and end up just becoming mainstream Washington scum. And he was correct, right? When those Republicans came in, there was all this stuff about, oh, they're going to finally get rid of the Department of Education and maybe two or three other federal departments and massively slash federal spending. And the opposite happened. And so there was that. And then, of course, there was the betrayal of the Republicans in the early Bush years and so many things, not just national security, but also with huge increases in welfare spending and just a general attempt to mimic the Democratic Party. And so there was that. And I mean, you can always just count on the party to backtrack and find their love of doing things the Washington way. And so, yeah, so I'm not going to bet my life savings or anything on the idea that the Republicans this time are going to get it right. Yeah, okay.
And to shamelessly plug the other show, Liberty versus Power, Patrick Newman and I just did an episode about how, like, this tendency goes back to, like, Jefferson himself. Like, right? The original Republicans, as soon as they take power, they immediately moderate to, like, the corrupt Washington class. So this is an American tradition right here of selling your soul as soon as you get into power.
Well, and speaking of people chickening out and backtracking, my next prediction is that the Fed will chicken out. And will not become this hawkish thing that it claims it's going to be. Powell's up there talking about, oh, yeah, we might have to tighten even faster than we said. We might have to raise rates even faster than before. And we've been here before. We've seen this before. In fact, on Twitter, some astute fellow posted headlines next to each other. It was an old, I believe, a 2018 headline talking about how Goldman Sachs sees four rate increases this year. And, you know, just a solid prediction. And, of course, that never happened. I think at the very end of the year, you got one tiny rate increase. And that's all that happened that year. And now, in a contrast to that headline with the current headline that just came out last week, saying that Goldman Sachs is confident that there's going to be four rate increases this year, and the Fed is just going to become mega hawkish, and it's going to end all purchases for its portfolio and so on. And I'm just not seeing that happen. I could see the Fed try a little bit of that, and then the markets tank. It looks like you might get a recession, and then they immediately reverse themselves. And the next thing you know, they're buying $80 billion in debt and mortgages, and they're deciding they're going to hold interest rates, the target rate, where it is for the foreseeable future because times have changed. It turns out the economy wasn't as strong as we thought it was, so we can't do all that tightening because they can't. Their only choice is between recession or continued inflation. So I think they're just going to choose inflation rather than risk a recession. And yeah, they're going to chicken out. They're not going to do it. It's not going to be a big change from what we've been seeing since 2009. And boy, and how many times have they predicted this, right? 2011, 2016, 2018, 2021, always talking about how the Fed's going to tighten again. But they don't have a plan. And I remember going to Fed meetings back when I worked for the state of Colorado, and it was the Division of Housing specifically. So I would go to all of this Fed stuff because the Fed's office there in Denver, which was a branch of the Kansas City Fed, would have a bunch of events. And I remember listening to their economists talking about, first of all, they got it wrong because they were talking about how it was going to be the fastest recovery ever after the Great Recession, because that's just what happens when you have a big dip. You have huge, rapid recoveries. That's not what happened. In fact, you ended up with 10 years of one of the worst recoveries ever. And they were wrong about that. And then they were just talking constantly about how they're going to unwind all of the QE that they were doing back then. Back then, they had only bought, say, about, at that point, $2 or $3 trillion in debt and mortgage-backed securities. And so how are you going to do this? Oh, we'll figure it out soon. We'll really start soon selling off the securities, and we're going to go back to normal. And that was like 2011. So that's just, I just don't see how that's going to happen. They just don't have the political backing. They don't have the plan. These economists freely admit they were surprised by the inflation that occurred in 2021. And so if they didn't even see that coming, why should we believe these people have any sort of plan in place? These PhDs are useless. They don't offer any special insight. They don't offer any special abilities in terms of economic management. They're going to be afraid. They're going to see that if they try to do any sort of backtracking on QE, it's going to be a political problem for whoever's in charge. And then that political pressure is going to come down on them. And then they're just afraid of starting a recession in general and that getting out of hand. So I do think they'll try a little bit of it, but I cannot imagine a world in which they tighten rates four times, which, mind you, would only be an increase of 1%. So even if they do that, of course, we're nowhere back to what you would consider to be normal interest rates. And I suppose maybe there's a 1 in 10 chance that they do that. But I think the 9 in 10 chances that they chicken out and don't do it.
No, I agree 100%. And, you know, really, the most important policy tool the Fed has is being able to gaslight the globe that they have the ability to tighten up more than they actually are. Like they have to convince people that they have a plan, that they can do these things. And it, in spite of the fact that time and time again, we've seen something comes up. I mean, just imagine this. You talk about the political consequences. You know, we're already dealing with an age of crazy real estate prices and housing being a major issue for working class Americans. You know, imagine interest rates going up, which makes houses even less affordable. Because, you know, while that might trigger some things in terms of underlying housing prices, chances are in the short term, at the very least, you're just going to have mortgage rates go up, which is going to only make it more expensive to first-time homebuyers and things like that. There's no way they're going to allow this, particularly in election year. And on the other side is that, like, I think one of those battles that will be a very interesting one is the renomination battle for Powell. Historically, this is a non-issue. But the number one political issue driving down Joe Biden's poll numbers is inflation. It's bigger than COVID. It's bigger than education. It's bigger than Afghanistan. It's bigger than anything else. The economy broadly, but inflation number one. And are you really going to have senators in the Republican Party actively putting their name next to Jay Powell? I think many of them would, but have no problem doing so. But I think there's probably going to be an advantageous, you know, you have that group, particularly within the House, the Republicans that love to use issues like this to go on Tucker Carlson, to rally kind of a conservative base mob against people they see as being rhinos and whatever generic insult you want. Fine. Maybe it's political opportunism, whatever. Ultimately, though, it still works. And I think inflation, the political consequences of inflation in 2022, particularly when the Fed shows that it can't do it. I mean, just think about this. You know, they're all fixated about, you know, we're constantly seeing overestimates about economic growth in America on job rates and everything else. Imagine if you start having, you know, when you really start having, you know, international problems. Alasdair MacLeod, we ran, I believe it was last week, the week before, a wonderful article highlighting the degree to which the state of the ECB's balance sheet is just full of crap financial products. Like the degree to which, like, you know, there's so much. It's not just debt, but it's bad debt. It's mispriced debt. It is risk that is so disconnected from anything resembling genuine market prices. Like, we're dealing with an international environment that, if the Fed starts tightening, is going to immediately create issues beyond anything that goes on here domestically. I agree 100%. I think this is going to be one of the defining political issues of this year going forward. And I'm also interested to see what is the political solution to this. You know, what can Republicans run on besides sort of vague promises of we're going to cut spending? It's like, well, no one believes that. To me, this is why one of my personal goals of 2022 is to interject Ron Paul's competing currency bill into as many Twitter conversations as I can. Because I think if you're looking for a practical policy that would, you know, again, you're not going to fix the Fed, right? That's the number one thing. The cause of inflation in this country isn't supply chains. It is PhD economists. And there's nothing that's going to change from that. And so if there's no way of fixing what the Fed is doing, the best policy outcome is creating as many lifeboats as possible to average Americans to allow them to save in things that aren't dollar-denominated assets. And so that Ron Paul competing currency bill, which would the main core of it was, you know, eliminating capital gains taxes on gold, silver, you know, cryptocurrencies, whatever. If we can get that interjected within mainstream political circles, particularly on the right, but whatever, you know, anyone runs the world, they go more power to them. That is something that, again, it's I think a very clever way of taking advantage of the inflation issue. Because again, it only takes 51 votes because of the tax cut too. And it's like, I think, you know, the politics of inflation is something that no one is prepared to talk about in DC at all. And I think that's where the Mises Institute has a very great opportunity in educating the public and filling a lot of voids that have been out there in terms of economic misinformation. Because you know, this is an issue that you know, we get a lot more than most.
Well, for our final prediction, let's just talk about COVID and what we think is going to happen with that this year. Now, for my part, I'm starting to see some significant changing in the messaging. Here in Colorado, for example, the governor has basically washed his hands of the whole thing in terms of statewide policy. Unfortunately, that also means is that he's letting like higher ed do their own thing. So there are still higher ed vaccine mandates for students and those sorts of things, which are a huge pain. And also are incoherent and stupid because now mandatory testing is only for the unvaccinated, whereas anyone who's even remotely paying attention can see that if you don't want people testing positive on your campus, you have to test everybody, not just the unvaccinated, because the vaccinated have COVID now all over the place. So the whole policy is incoherent and clearly punitive. But nevertheless, in terms of putting down any sort of statewide mask mandate or anything like that on just anybody who's not actually in a government institution, that's all over. The Polis said, yeah, that's over. Get vaccinated if you're concerned about the disease. Now, and you can see I was just reading a column this morning from people to the left of him are still all mad. They're writing columns about how Polis isn't hard enough on the vaccine or isn't hard enough on the virus. And if he would only instate another stay-at-home order, then countless lives would be saved. Now, these people are out to lunch, right? These people still think that you can put together some sort of stay-at-home order and that this will make a big difference. And you're seeing actual people have to answer to the voters. They've already abandoned that, even in New York State. Because now you're starting to see the New York governor saying, oh, we're going to start counting COVID cases differently in hospitals now. Now I want to be more clear on whether someone happens to have COVID while they're in the hospital to treat a broken leg or whether they went in there because of COVID symptoms and so on. That was saying that sort of thing would have gotten you banned from social media a year ago. Now that the governor of New York says it. And now we've got medical institutions saying, even if you test positive for COVID, go ahead and come on in because we have a staff shortage. So one minute, these people needed to isolate for 10 days and you were basically a leper. Now, even if you're symptomatic, come on in. We'll figure out. We'll make it work. And this is the sort of thing where if you said that on social media, you would have been dismissed as some sort of crazy man. And so now what was considered a conspiracy theory 1 year ago is now stuff that's said on CNN, because I saw that Jake Tapper's now talking about how it doesn't make any sense to count everybody in a hospital with COVID as a COVID hospitalization. And so something obviously changed there.
The CDC is now coming out on that. Like, you know, we're getting that from the approved public channels now where they are trying desperately to shape this narrative. I think of like one of some of the high profile Twitter bannings of people like Alex Berenson, the independent reporter has been doing a lot of stuff. Like he was kicked off of Twitter for simply pointing out the Israeli data that showed that vaccines were not stopping the spread. And now, I mean, Omicron was kind of the perfect variant and just completely destroying all of the narratives that the left had been sold to. And what's going to be interesting is that you've already seen this play out where there is a federal, I think there's a concerted effort at the federal level to pivot the narrative. Meanwhile, though, there's still a lot of Democrats in the state level who are not Jared Polis. And I think Jared Polis is going to be one of the big winners from the Democratic Party in the long term on that, which I think is interesting. That might deserve its own show later. There's still a lot of Democrats in state levels and local levels who they only know lockdown. They only know escalation, right? You know, the hammer, everything's a nail, right? And I think that there really is this psychological issue where there's so many on the left that are broken. Like they're so terrified of this virus that, you know, there's always been kind of this cliche that, you know, for decade plus now that the Republican Party is being dragged down by crazies. Right. You know, Alex Jones people and, you know, they used it against Tea Party people and they used it against, the caricature of like the militant like a conservative Christian trying to, you know, burn the books and stopping dancing at high schools, right? The left, I think, is now going to be dictated by the crazies on their side, where they simply refuse to embrace, you know, any sort of attempt at normalizing. And I don't think those people are going to go away. And so I think this is going to create a big split, you know, going forward. I don't know how they're going to pivot out of this, which, again, it is what I'm also interested to see on the other side is that, you know, I think you're going to see a drumbeat for accountability on the right. I think this is one of those issues that will demonstrate whether the Republican Party is salvageable or not. And it is whether or not there are serious attempts at accountability to people involved in the COVID thing from the beginning, including, you know, you have Rand Paul out there calling for jailing Fauci at the very least for lying to Congress. Matt Gaetz is taking that on. I think that's one of those issues where you could see a drumbeat, particularly at primaries, of jailing Fauci. And if that was able to happen, like, again, I'd be betting against it. I don't think that's going to happen. But if that was, let's say that you know, there is a serious attempt at criminal charges against Fauci, which should happen, that would be such a gigantic shift politically for this country if you have a bureaucrat actually held liable for what they've done. Again, you know, it wasn't that long ago we had the locker up chance for Hillary Clinton. Every reason to bet against that happening. But should that happen, I think it's something we could see. And I think all of this in general, though, kind of goes to my last prediction, which is that I think Biden's approval numbers in December of 2022 are going to be worse than they were in December of 2021. And so, again, this I think is a very optimistic thing for us generally, where there's so much legitimacy. When they started using the grown-up in the room card, when all of their framing of the Trump era as a bunch of crazies have taken over and we need to reinstall all these great guardians of democracy and the adults that know what to do and, you know, we can't have this crazy man running things. When your average American feels worse off in late 2022 than they did in 2019, I think the credibility of these institutions is going to continue this dramatic cut that we're already seeing. And I think the opportunity there to really mobilize Americans against the regime on this sort of it's going to be on a scale that we haven't seen before. And again, maybe nothing comes from that. Maybe it's another missed opportunity. We've certainly had plenty of those in the past. But I think the regime is in trouble. And sure do love to see it.
What do you think are the top two things? So you've got then 2 years of lame duck Joe Biden. And so what are the top two things that need to be done during those 2 years?
It's a two-prong attack. One is you need Republicans at the state level fortifying things and doing everything they can. You know, DeSantis mold. Again, that's why I think the Abbott primary would be a big shot across the bow there. But since you're not going to enact legislation. You know, I think investigations, I think, you know, the Republican Party in power should be using their position to make life a living hell for your average Biden administration official. This thing in the same way that the Democrats did against the Trump years, right, when they took over. That's the model they should be using. And they should put some real teeth there. Because, again, you're not going to get anything done from a policy standpoint, but use the theater of these things. Like use the things that you can control as an opposition party with the legislature. Again, what I think is interesting is that there are some people within the Republican Party that seem to get this. You know, when you had Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene spend an entire day, you know, dedicated to counter programming and really, like, again, not simply ignoring the January 6th stuff, but really pushing, hey, look, no, the feds instigated this and deliberately to use this against Trump. Like that, if that message becomes normalized within the GOP broadly, I think that makes that party very, very interesting. My fear is that you're going to have Kevin McCarthy be Speaker of the House again, that, you know, they're going to forgive and let go. We need to focus on the things that Americans really care about and we need policy stuff instead of looking in the past, right? You know, all those Washington cliches. That's what I expect will happen. But if it doesn't, again, it would be, I think, a very positive thing, trend in terms of this larger party system in the realignment that we've talked about earlier.
All right. Well, that's going to have to be it for this episode of Radio Rothbard. Thank you for listening, as always. And until next time, we'll see you then. Thanks.